Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore, and in this episode, Scott Allen, our Learning and Discovery Practice Director at BSA, joins the show to discuss the future of learning and discovery. Scott has been a guest on this show a few times over the past year and has great insight and passion on the learning and discovery markets. As we covered in the last episode, The Future of Healing, I only thought it would be fitting that we give Scott the same opportunity to take a look at what's coming in the learning and discovery markets. Welcome back to the show, Scott. It's great to have you back on.
Yeah, Brian, I'm always really happy to join you for these conversations. They're always so much fun.
Whenever we're together, I hear you talk a lot with some excitement, passion about the learning and discovery markets. And I know you've got thoughts and insight as to what might be coming next. And this podcast is following up the one that we just did with Tim Spence about the future of healing. So let's talk a little bit about the future of learning and discovery. First, I'd like to know where we're going. Let's look at where we're at. What are some of the most impactful changes that you see in educational facilities?
Yeah, great question. Well, of course, it's something that's continually evolving. And I think it's really evolved in a significant way in the last really 10 years or more. That's been driven a lot by technology, a lot by the opportunity to have not only a virtual presence in your classroom, but also to have a really kind of an extension outside the classroom. That's a really important part of this. It really kind of makes the classroom really just a place of discovery, but also a place that can launch into the world at any given time or broadcast back into the world. A kind of a unique experience, probably from where we were in school back in those days. Right? It was really kind of, you were contained in that space. The discussion and dialogue in that space was really contained at the same time. Not that that was bad. That was a strength in its own way. That can occur today still, but now you can go out and do that. You have the idea of AI that goes into this now with really kind of augmented environments that you can really kind of create as a part of that too. And it's just this really place of diverse learning, discussion, and really kind of debate that can happen about what's going on with learning. And the lab side of things, if you go into research side of it within learning too, there's really kind of unique aspect to that. The research side allows you now to think through things in a way that you never could before and speed that you couldn't before. You can predict things through AI, maybe in a way that you couldn't have before, run tests in a way that happened that were never even possible to even consider. It's amazing where things are going. It's exciting to watch. It's actually caused us as designers to have to think in a different way, really kind of create this place that's multifaceted for all these possibilities and whatever possibilities come in the future.
I'll steal a term I've heard before. Paint with some broad strokes and give me a vision for the learning space design and evolution kind of overall.
I'll go back originally to where I started a minute ago, where learning was really kind of originally in contexts that were much smaller, right? They were in a lecture hall, they were in spaces like that. But now what we're seeing is these classes that are learning classrooms that are actually tackling real world problems. So, you know, before you learn about things that maybe occurred historically as a learning kind of tool, that occurs, but that's set as the baseline. And then the problem is put forth to the students to kind of challenge themselves on how to address that. And they're getting into real world things that we're seeing not only in the news or things that are happening in research or things that are happening in theory, but they're tackling those then. And oftentimes that was being waited until after you're done your education. That's happening now. So it's accelerated that process in a way that never used to be possible in consideration. I actually think it's focusing on critical thinking because we're realizing that critical thinking is such a significant part of what students need to learn and harvest for them to be successful, not only in life, but really kind of in whatever pursuit they do in their studies or beyond in a profession or anything else afterward.
It seems like a change in like you said, used to be you had to go and do all the, you know, follow all these steps. And then you could start working on these things. And now it seems like it's more combined hand in hand sort of way.
It's much more integrated. I would also tell you that they're getting, classrooms are getting to the point where they're also, and the education process is getting where you're having more real world experience. It used to be that you go off and do an internship, right? You had to go to that business or go to that thing. Now that's actually happening much more, even more integrated into the curricula. You're seeing that actually corporations and others are getting involved in helping develop curricula for students, be a part of that in a very different way. They come and lecture or are a guest lecturer for the entire semester, and they help run that project. It's a very different integration than used to be there before. It's a world where before it was very regimented or there was a structure to it. Now that's much more open, and it's almost the integration is not, there's a blurred line between education and the real world a little bit better than it used to be. And I think students are coming out much more prepared as a part of that process as well.
Absolutely. And that's the goal, right? We want them contributing early on instead of having to wait for something. Let's look at technology integration and learning at lab spaces and how you see that happening in the future.
Sure. Absolutely. And I'll go back to AI. AI obviously is a buzzword that everybody talks about, but you know, it's also this thing that allows so many things to happen. It allows for personalized learning environments to happen for certain students, for groups in what they're doing. It allows for adaptive learning environments for all types of students. Again, it allows for really data collection and consideration as these students try to tackle these problems that are going on in whatever they're doing, whether it be research or in a classroom setting. The interesting part about that, again, you look at the amount of data that we're able to crunch and the queries we're able to make. Things that used to take days to do, you can do in minutes, or you can do in 20 or 30 minutes as a part of a bigger, more complex thing. Code to get written as a test as a part of this whole part of the thing to kind of do software or any of those kind of things is so different as well. And so it allows that dialogue to make leaps or discussion to and problem solving to go in leaps in ways that it never did before because of that.
It's speed too, right? Like, as you were saying, once upon a time, my first major was what they called then new media. It's now old media, but it was website design and things like that. And you would have to sit there for days to write the code to get a website up. And now to your point, we've got all these services. You can get a website up within, you know, 20, 30 minutes if you wanted to. And it allows you then to tackle other more complex things. So I find that all fascinating.
I mean, I think that's, again, if I go back to the idea of critical thinking, that's really the thing that we're trying to teach, because that's where we still have value that AI or some of those things aren't able to do in the same way. We're able to reason thought, we're able to critically think and make assessments maybe in ways that they're not with that data. With this is a tool for us to actually move forward faster, and then we still are responsible for doing that in a way that is makes a contribution.
Let's hone in a little bit on AI-enhanced learning spaces. How do you design for them for this personalized learning? So what is some of the infrastructure that's needed for these adaptive learning systems? And then I've heard you speak on some of the data collection and privacy considerations that there are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny, right? I mean, we never thought a classroom was going to need its own little data center. We thought, oh, well, it was just a server that sat in the closet or that was, and we thought that was big, right? In those days. And now it's so much more than that. It's a matter of trying to make sure that you have the right bandwidth, the right ways to sit there and, you know, like I said, if it's a data server to really crunch numbers and those types of things. And so we had to build that into the capacity of the room. The other thing we're starting to realize is video is a huge part of this, right? So whether it's broadcasting out or broadcasting into your classroom is a big part of it as well. And we used to see that our instructors would oftentimes be at the front of the classroom or in those places. Now we're creating environments where they can be very mobile. They walk around with an iPad or a tablet, and that is their way of interacting with every single flat screen on the room with the students. It's also their way of talking. They could put up an exhibit as a part of the question of what's going on, all those types of things. It's very interesting. I mean, it's almost like you're sitting there and you're the president of the United States and you have a teleprompter. They also have a screen that allows them to put some of their thoughts up there so they can see it as notes, as courtesy, as they're going through this process, because they're in an environment that's so much more rich and things are going on and they have to find a way to kind of send it themselves back into what's going on in with the process as well. So we're really creating just environments that have as much technology flexibility as possible to make those things happen and allow for things that we can't even conceive of yet. And that's really what it is. Sight lines are such a big conversation. I don't think when we're in school, we ever worried about view lines to an instructor or view lines to a screen either. Any of those types of things. You have a microphone at your desktop oftentimes, or sometimes you can for your group or yourself. It's a very different environment. And I think students today, they're so used to being on their phones and things, being on display, being presenting that way would have been daunting to us. To them, that's just the way they've been brought up in their digital world.
That's very true. That I wanted to ask you about was that data collection and privacy stuff.
It's a really crazy thing, right? I mean, IP has always been such an important part of research. It's always been such an important part of education when you go and present a paper or those types of things. I think the idea of having like open science, as an example, is a really complex thing. I mean, it's a needed thing, right? We would not solve the serums for the pandemic unless we had open science and collaboration. And that wouldn't have been possible in the same way, 20, 30, 40 years ago as it was when the pandemic occurred back in 2020. I think that's a great example. I think people are understanding that they have to give up or share IP for them to actually progress forward themselves. Where before it was kind of hoarding it, right? Because of the value of what you brought was you either published or you perished or you had that information and you were the expert. You become an expert and you're sharing your expertise now in a very different way than it was.
Well, and I think there's also the part where we have the power to review it as well. I mean, this is not related to the learning part, but I'm thinking of just in a general sense, but if you had a lecture, you would sit and you took notes longhand. And some of the same things continue to happen even now in meetings. I can be sitting there and I can either take notes on my computer or I can write it out longhand or just jot some notes. What I've noticed, and we just had a call this morning with a couple folks on our team, and I turned on the Zoom AI summary feature. And when it was done, it sent me all the summary notes. Here's what we talked about. Here were the to-dos that came out of it. And it was like, I now can engage in a full conversation and not have to worry about it. Did I miss, three things that somebody was talking about because I was trying to take notes? That's a big step forward, in my opinion, and in a very small way, of course, right?
I'll give you one other example that's a little bit more unique, maybe. And it happens at both the higher education level, it happens now even at the K-12 level, is you're seeing corporations that are supporting programs for really STEM. As an example, I'll give Lockheed Martin's maybe a really good example that I know personally about here locally in Colorado. And they're supporting aerospace and engineering programs at high schools. So those students are actually doing real world challenges. They're attacking and building models to look at those types of things. That's IP that they're bringing to them, but that's because they want to afford it so they can create those next level of, not only students, but ultimately employees that are interested in that, have that baseline and take it further than they can imagine even today.
That's a really good example for sure. Let's talk a little bit about virtual and augmented reality and how, what are some of those things? I've got down some notes about XR lab requirements and flexible learning spaces and immersive learning spaces, and then the hybrid environment design.
Sure. I think it can be applied a whole bunch of different ways. Certainly in our business, we see the VR world as it relates to how we model the drawings of buildings or spaces that we go into. We can see that in the world of education in the same way. I would tell you that you see it not only in buildings, but you would see it like in medical education. You could go through the entire anatomy of a body that way in a virtual presence. And you can look at those types of things. You can actually see surgeries being done that way or thought about how those processes would be done in those types of ways. I mean, it's really kind of almost endless what you could think about. You could look at different engineering problems on strengths of different materials or how a bridge is constructed and where the weakness points are for engineering students, all those types of things. That doesn't replace the real world testing of those labs, because you go to structural testing labs at schools for engineering programs. They still build those walls and break them down and all those kind of things because it's just as important to do that. But you can talk about so many different versions of it in a virtual way and then have one that they test on their own. And it probably is so much more advanced than what we've ever done in an education setting like that before.
I'm thinking of the Apple Vision Pro that came out just about a year ago. And you could take this and spin it in so many different directions. But even thinking of like what you were saying, I was a history major. And if I had the ability to augment or use the virtual reality to put myself at the pyramids of Giza and explore something or look through an Egyptian tomb, I know these things are expensive, but it's also really expensive to travel there and to do some of these things. So the possibilities are certainly endless, but I think its real asset is the fact of what you're talking about is architects and engineers that don't have to physically be on site sometimes to be able to look and solve these problems, which is really helpful. It just saves time and in some cases, I'm sure money. So,
well, and to your point about if you could travel to see the pyramids or those kind of things, I mean, think about students that don't have the ability to travel. How they might get their interest completely piqued in a totally different way about that and focus on those types of things. Being able to do a virtual tour or something. Think about how much more engaged they are than looking at it in a book and maybe three pictures that are really small and probably 30 years old.
Yes, they're flat, they're 2D.
It's a completely different engagement of education and learning.
Oh, so cool.
And I think the other thing it's trying to do is it's trying to make sure that we set up lifelong learning. We've talked about it for a long time. But this lifelong learning happens on a day-to-day basis. And especially now with technology, it makes it much more easy to do and access that. You don't have to go to a World Book Encyclopedia and then look up five books in the card catalog in a library. Unfortunately, that's still a great way to go learn, but it's not the same thing. And this engagement level allows students and anybody, honestly, to really further themselves, further what we do as a species in this way, in a totally different way than they've ever considered.
We're just one step short from teleporting, right?
Yeah, just about. I mean, we laugh about those kind of things, but I hope not that they're as far off as we think they are.
I don't think so either. I certainly hope so. We were promised it in, you know, movies like Back to the Future, so I'm ready for it.
Oh, I was ready for it when the Jetsons had it on cartoon. Yeah,
right? Exactly. There we go.
By far and the whole bit, right?
Like, Yep. Let's turn our attention a little bit to labs and talk maybe about quantum computing, biotech, genomics, and nanotechnology. I heard you obviously talk about some of these things before, but the genomics really piqued my interest too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, that's the thing that we see. Like we've been constantly striving to try to eradicate certain diseases or those types of things. And oftentimes they take years and years of trials and those types of things to go solve. And they start in, with animal trials, and then they hopefully progress to human trials for those benefits. We can create those models now virtually to some extent before we have to go out and do that. The great part about that is that doesn't impact any of those species or people that we talked about. There's so many side effects that you learn from. You can learn some of those side effects virtually now and get forward in that, and hopefully get to the point when you're actually testing it in a human that's so much easier to do. So genomics or immunotherapeutics, we're working on a project right now for a client that really is doing those kind of things. It's really kind of what used to be called bench to bedside. It still occurs today, where you're really taking what is a part of the human genome itself, or the body and some of those cells and those things, and reconstituting them in a way to fight a disease. And it's a really important part of how cancers are being treated in these days, all these types of things, and giving people opportunities to hopefully live longer, get those things eradicated that used to really take down portions of the population. It's a really great thing. If you go and look at some of the other pieces of what that's really about on the lab side, again, quantum computing, that allows us to really look at things in a much smaller way, but it also expands how we get to go and do it. And it's from everything from the watch that you have on your wrist, looking at, it may not be the most sophisticated, it may not be the most accurate yet, but it can get to a whole bunch of your different things about your health in an instant. You push a button and you can see your heartbeat off your wrist. You push a button, you can see your breaths off your wrist. You can, they're saying now that the Apple watches are going to consider being able to look and measure your glucose level off your wrist without having to do an injection. That's an insane idea. And that's all about looking at things at the quantum level and allowing them to go come back into the world that we're working in and doing that. And it gives insight for doctors to know what your up and down kind of thing is. If you have a blood pressure issue, if you have a heart rate issue, it may not, but it's now really real world every day, not having to take your blood pressure kind of thing. And it can, and now you can download it off of those things too, your watch, your tablet, and all that kind of stuff.
This is where I see our three markets overlapping the most, right? Is in this space where, and you touched on it when we were talking about the personal information. So I've got to give up some of my privacy, if you will. But when I'm giving that up, and to your point, I've got all this data, my blood type, my breathing cadences, my blood pressure, all these sorts of things. And then I'm stricken with something, And using that data, it feels very much more targeted. How are you as an individual body going to react, given all of this data that we have on you, to this, you know, proposed solution, whether it's a drug or a treatment of some kind, instead of looking at it like, well, we've ran tests on people, and not that that's a bad way, that's how we've been able to do it, but it's like, well, here's the side effects that we know about out of the pool of people that we tested it on, as opposed to this we know is going to happen because you as an individual have these things going on. And I think that's where the future is wide open to really individualized personal treatment. So
absolutely. And personalized medicine and the research that goes behind that is exactly what you said. I mean, hopefully we get to a point where we are able to, let's just say, cure or provide a vaccine towards addressing something. But we can actually personalize that if you have some other issues that you have in your health history, so you don't have the same side effects that someone else would have. Because it's not a, because right now the situation is that vaccine is a one size fits all. And we're not one size fits all people. Not a single one of us is the same.
Well,
as the
we all have thousands of years of genetic history that is flowing through each one of us individually. And there's precursors, then there's our daily diets and all these things to consider. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Environmental exposures from all of the places, all kinds of things you could ever imagine.
Right. I wanted to have you talk for a moment about the nanotechnology as well.
Oh, sure. I mean, nano is the thing that started with the semiconductor and is moving forward today, right? I mean, the CHIPS Act that's there within the government and all those things. And it's a real big part of where science is going, at least in the kind of mechanics world, engineering world. Like you talk to the top universities about their focuses when you talk to them about their engineering programs, it's quantum mechanics. It's those kind of things that drive it. That's everything from now. I think back when we went in the 60s, we walked in the moon. I don't think anybody ever thought you could get to Mars, but that's what it's pushing us towards the considerations of like Star Wars, you know, actually living in that environment.
Right.
That being real. And, you know, you can get one of your limbs, your hand knocked off, and you can go and put a mechanical hand on there and it's in a day. But those things only happen because of this kind of research and those kind of things that are being pushing.
Absolutely.
It's a little scary. Again, it takes thoughtful restraint on some of it to consider it in a way that's responsible. And I think, honestly, that if we go back again to this thought of open science, I think the sharing of that is forcing people to think as a collective about what's responsible. I think you could create things off in a corner before, and you might have been responsible on your own, or you might not have been responsible on your own, and you brought the same to the world. Now it's a collective community of responsibility because of the way the research is being done.
Well, and I'm going to shift a little bit to ask you, so you were talking about things that happened maybe when we were going through school. I know we're both parents of school-age children, and I've also had my oldest graduate college, my second oldest is in college. And then the three others are in K through 12. So I'm curious, what's a couple of the key areas education may be evolving with in the future?
I think it's the one I mentioned earlier about corporations being involved and allowing those opportunities to be there. I think, you know, if I had ever had the opportunity and where, you know, I talk to my son about it often, you know, what do you want to do? He's like, I want to do something that I can have as a hands-on thing. Like, so I go back to the institutions kind of partnering with like the Lockheed Martins of the world or whoever else. And he's ultimately super fascinated with the sky, the stars, all those types of things. They put satellites into the world with what they do for GPS and all kinds of different other things like that, among many, many other things that they do. Those are the kind of things that I think now they can actually touch and see in a very different way through those kind of programs that you see in those schools, where you can go to a dedicated school that is a STEM school that just focuses on engineering and science and the mathematics. I think that's really where we're seeing the benefit. I knew there was a pharmaceutical company when I was working in California, and they were working with the community college and working with creating that curriculum for students so they could have those students become their future employees and have them understand the science they're trying to do at that pharma as lab techs or anything else as they progressed in their careers, and having that right baseline based on what they're bringing to the table. It's, again, sharing some of that idea of the IP. You have to give up a little bit to make leaps as a corporation, as an individual in education and other ways.
So earlier you also mentioned a little bit about lifelong learning. What kind of goes into multi-generational design considerations?
Oh, it's an interesting thing. I think when we look at like education, originally, you know, it was the idea, at least at the higher education level, that most students were ones that were there during the day. They didn't have full-time jobs. They didn't necessarily have families, you know, that they were juggling in the midst of all this. I think the access that we get now because of, you know, having classes that can be like this online or hybrid, you can be in person or you can take it online, is really a critical part of it. And you're catering to all types of different students, creating those environments. You even have to create environments in your buildings now or in your student unions to consider for respite for these people that work all day or work three quarters of a day, want to take a nap, maybe potentially in all seriousness, and then go to a couple evening classes. It's a real consideration. And then the other thing you're creating is spaces for them to have collaboration, because like I said, group learning is such a big part of how things go now. It's even the way it is at the high school and middle school level for students. They're having group learning assignments besides their individual learning assignments too. And so they're trying to diversify. We never had group learning before you got to college. And even then, it wasn't as prevalent when we were in college. And so project. Then you got to the real world, and that was what you had to do.
People work on something. Yeah. Oh, good. So we're talking about the changes all around us. We're talking about building learning environments, lab spaces, and these things. So then that would also mean that students need to evolve when we're talking about education to adapt to this. How do you see students evolving in the future to their environment?
I think it's still one of the key things that we always encountered when we were students, ask a lot of questions. And I think don't be afraid to push boundaries. I think before we never had the opportunity to think about it, software, or read about something that we could then try to bring into the context of what we're doing. Now those things you can do. If you read about it or you hear about it, I don't think there's a limitation necessarily of trying to get a piece of software or trying to create a partnership with another university that may be doing similar research, or, you know, hey, I heard they're talking about this and bring someone here to go be a part of that to teach at your school for a period of time. All those things, they happen in similar ways, but not in the way that we can do it today and not in the way that you can be as impactful as you are today.
It feels like, too, with some of the demographic shifts and especially a global connection that didn't exist when 25 years ago when we were all going through school, you've got international students and all that as well. So it's like this world has evolved in such a way that it makes that a lot more possible. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I actually think, too, to your point about the demographic shift or even kind of the commingling of international students more in the United States than maybe what we saw. If you've gone to school in Europe, you probably saw it much more than we saw it here in the States, but it's certainly happening here now in the States. Your perspective of global understanding of what this is on a topic is so different. Your perspective of just even understanding how to relate to those people is very, very different. Because, you know, I was very lucky when I was in college, I was able to study over in Europe for a period of time. And there was about 8 of us that were in residence where I was studying. And we would travel often, but there was a great diversity. We had a Japanese national with us. We had someone from El Salvador. We had 2 people from Russia. It was this great kind of melting pot of people. And you learn to really kind of relate to them in a different way. And it gave you a totally different perspective of the world.
So I'm sure somewhere out there, someone's listening to this and thinking, this all sounds great, but it sounds very expensive. How does this stuff get paid for?
Well, I think that's the current challenge, right? I'm going to go back to one of the things I kept talking about. I think it's really part of the partnerships that you get with corporations help pay for these things, right? It's or you see that there's a different level of integration between the higher ed kind of education experience to high school experience. My son goes to an international baccalaureate high school. So he's allowed to go even then to take college courses if he wanted his junior and senior year. And I think what we're finding is, like a lot of things, is the efficiency of how that can be shared also equates to an efficiency of cost, right? So you're allowing multiple generations of students to use the same spaces, to use the same curriculums or courses, and it allows a whole level of different understanding about that. You look at like universities that are focused on engineering research of subsurface types. So there's the schools of mines that sit out here in the West as a good example. And they're all, you know, supported by a large part of the petroleum companies, because it's the research that helps them move forward, but it helps fund what they can do at schools. And one of the schools here in Colorado, in fact, even has its own mine, literally operating mine that they have classroom it's those things are actually operational, making money on their own, and then also becoming educational environments. Same.
So how does sustainability fit into some of this financial innovation? Because I think I've heard you mention a couple terms, operating cost reduction, energy efficient design, and long-term adaptability.
Sure. Well, long-term adaptability is pretty simple, right? It just allows for multi-purpose spaces that if you design them correctly with as much flexibility as you can, which does cost a little bit more upfront, but allows it to have a longer life. It's the idea of a loose fit, long life kind of thing, right? Because it allows things to happen there. Operational side of things, you have the biggest investment or the biggest cost to any university is their building stock, right? And the cost of operating those. So how can you most efficiently do that? Those have been out there as considerations for a long time. A lot of schools are trying to go now to being electrified. That allows for energy to come from different sources. That could be from PV, that could be from wind farms, all those types of things that help that to be translated differently than if you use a petroleum-based energy source to create your energy on campus. It's also ones that can be, I think, upgraded much more easily going forward in the future as that technology improves, increases, and so forth. There too.
Jumping back a little bit to the Discover space, what are some future-based collaborations you potentially see happening?
It's interesting. You mentioned earlier kind of where our three practice areas really kind of come together. I really see that for those in our conversation, that's really healthcare, learning, so higher education primarily, and then certainly science and technology. You know, I think that's happening in a lot of places, but I think the place that happens the most is academic medical centers and the research areas around those, because they're training, you know, the future doctors, the future nurses, and all those things along the way. But it's also the research that goes on there that helps treat those patients, getting back to the conversation about bench to bedside, those types of things. I think we as a practice are very focused on making sure that we make significant impact on what we do in our buildings and with our clients' lives. And everybody in the world in doing that. And that's one of the main places we're seeing that occur is in those academic medical centers and places like that. It's fortunately one of the places you can get the best treatment in the United States for healthcare, but it's also the best research goes on there. My wife is in that world of academia, and she talks about the research she used to do as she's a practicing physician now. And she talks about that's the place you want to be if you want to be at the forefront of medicine.
Absolutely. Similar question, more geared, I think, towards Discovery, though. We hear a lot about national challenges or even global challenges. How will the Discovery market address these in the future?
It's interesting. I think there's a university that I had been working with for a couple of years on the project, and they were setting up a set of series of core focuses that they wanted to try to tackle. And those were anything from sustainable resiliency within the world. So looking at sort of the challenges that we have. Unfortunately, as we talk today, there's been the significant fires out in Los Angeles. Forest fires being one of those. Earthquakes are another. Floods are another. Looking at how the environmental conditions that we create maybe make those things worse than they could have been in the past, or how we start to mitigate those. There's a lot of research going into that right now. There's research going into the idea of how to address future pandemics, things that impact the world or a significant population in a large way. And I think in the Discovery world, that research is going to be how we start to solve some of those problems, or how we start to make an impact on some of, you know, the challenges we've created as a society or a culture by the way we inhabit our land or the environment we expose ourselves to, right? Because our illnesses are created by some of the environments we expose ourselves to. So we're like almost reverse engineering it. We have the problem, we're trying to solve it by looking at, well, what did we create that now created the problem that we have?
That's a very good point. So when we talk about the future, it's really easy to get excited. I'm super pumped about it. As I like to say all the time, I feel like I'm a futurist, but it's also those key considerations that you're talking about. Sometimes you got one foot on the accelerator, and then you're not quite sure what's around the corner, so you kind of hover over the brake or maybe even tap on it to slow down with some caution. That's kind of a way of setting up this question of what are some key considerations we need to think about in the future in terms of learning and discovery.
I think it's always going to be a situation where the classroom spaces or lab spaces within an academic environment are always ones that are going to continue to need to be more flexible, need to be able to address kind of the new equipment we're using. But the bigger part of it is really kind of this conversation about how we share and the ethics behind that and the privacy sides of it. I think that's honestly, it's one of the bigger issues that we have to solve, no matter if it's education or research-based, either way. And I don't know if it's something that we're always going to, it's going to be a solve. It probably will be incrementally solved, or agreements will come to how it's getting utilized. I mean, that's even today in our media, right? You're looking at what you put on your Instagram or whatever, and that becomes out there for the world forever. And that's your choice, but that's you giving up some privacy to do so, right? And, you know, so I think there's that aspect of it. I think it's also, we're going to see not only education, but I think we're going to see research be very honed in on the challenges that we're kind of seeing as cultures and societies, as I told you. Natural disasters, the problems of pandemics, the problems of how we create the next level of engineering, kind of whether it be nano or beyond that. Oh, and I think the thing about it is humans still have that aspect of how they can critically think, right? And assess things. As much as we have reason, that's our strength. And until research or science or engineering catches up to that, which I think is a way away, even though we have AI and other things kind of coming towards that, that's our strength, is to be able to do that. And how we take now those things that are able to be done more quickly and analyze them for us to move forward in both research and education is going to be the key.
Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on to talk about it. I know it's a thing that we've both been excited about, and I've heard you and Tim speak on it. So I want to do a little two-parter here. I can't wait to see where things are going, and I'd probably like to have you back on maybe a year from now and kind of reevaluate and see what it looks like then. Sound good?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brian, as I said at the outset of this conversation, I always enjoy meeting with you and having these conversations. It's really fun to talk about this. It's a little scary in some ways sometimes too, I will also say, but I will also say the idea of revisiting it periodically is a really good idea. It's something that's continually evolving. I think we know what we know today. We won't know what we know 6 months from now, right? Like it's constant. And that's what's exciting about it, is hopefully we make the right decisions and are responsible about what we do with the information we have or the research and all those types of things. But at the same point, you just don't know what could be conquered from what we did before and had been a challenge for such a long time for us.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good punctuation on this episode. Thanks a lot, Scott. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Brian. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Scott again for joining us on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. To learn more about our learning and discovery practice, we encourage you to visit bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us as well for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. We've got more content project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.